We have a whole lot going on at Renegade University. First of all, we've just added 10 new VIP tickets to the Freedom Event of the Year, Renegade University in Texas, in Lockhart. Go to renegadeuniversity.com/Texas to get tickets, either VIP or general weekend tickets, to join me, Hotep Jesus, Scott Horton, Cody Wilson, Deirdre McCluskey, and Jack the Perfume Nationalist with Buck Johnson of the Counterflow podcast. That's October 8th to the 10th, and tickets are going very fast. This will be the event of the year. So again, renegadeuniversity.com/Texas for that. Also, we have two brand new webinars that will be starting in September on very different topics, taught by very brilliant instructors. We have The War on Beauty in the 21st Century, taught by the great Jack the Perfume Nationalist. Can't wait for this one. It is a cultural history of our time that is unlike any you will ever hear or see anywhere else. Go to renegadeuniversity.com/courses for more information and to enroll in The War on Beauty with Jack of the Perfume Nationalist. We also have, coming up in September, an instructional design for dying, taught by Tom Nickel, who has been on Unregistered. This will be an 8-part webinar that will change your life and the way that you think about your own death. Go to renegadeuniversity.com/courses again for more information and to enroll in these upcoming webinars and to take all of our courses in our video catalog. I hope to see you in class.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think.
What if civilization requires us to be a little drunk? This is my interview with Edward Slingerland. I am joined from Vancouver, British Columbia, by Edward Slingerland, a professor, distinguished professor at the University of British Columbia, whose book, Drunk, is, for a lot of listeners will know, that's very consistent with a lot of the work that I have done on alcohol and drinking. And really glad to have you on. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
So the book does, I would say, it does several things, but I guess the major sections to me, the major arguments have to do with the science of drinking, intoxication, alcohol. And then there's really interesting stuff. It's all interesting, but to me, the second half of the book, where you talk about the history of civilization and its relationship with drinking, to me is really fascinating because I've always been interested primarily in Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents.
Okay. Yeah. And I've taught that book.
Yeah, I could tell. I mean, I've heard you actually address that in some other interviews, but I really want to, if you don't mind, I'd like to get into that sort of toward the end of this conversation, because that to me is like the real crux of it. And that's where like a lot of my work sort of overlaps with yours, but in different ways. So it's really great. So let's do, first of all, what's very odd on the surface about you is that you are you're an early Chinese philosophy scholar. And people would say, well, how did you get into the study of intoxication? How's that connected? Let's do that. And then let's talk about the science. And then let's do the history of civilization. So how did you get from studying early Chinese philosophy to talking about drunks?
So my early research, my dissertation, my first monograph are about this concept in early China that wu-wei, which I translate as effortless action. Mm-hmm. So it's this state where you are spontaneous, you're relaxed, everything works perfectly, you're creative, you solve problems, you're charismatic, people like you, people trust you. All of the early Chinese thinkers that I study have this as a goal. They want to get you into this state of wu-wei. But I argue kind of the new thing I argued in my dissertation was that they all face this, what I call the paradox of wu-wei. It's a tension of how can you try not to try? They want you to be spontaneous. You're not spontaneous now. How do you get from a state of not being spontaneous into being spontaneous? It seems like it defeats itself, and it does. So I actually, in my trade book, so my first trade book was about this tension. It was called Try Not to Try. Mm-hmm. And I point out that it is a direct cognitive paradox, because when you're trying not to try, if you're trying to relax, the part of your brain you're activating is actually the part you're trying to shut down. So right. It's directly counterproductive. So in the book, in my research and in the first trade book, I talk about various strategies the Chinese philosophers come up with to kind of run around this paradox, to get around it indirectly. So meditation practices, ritual practices, there's different ways you can kind of trick your brain into not trying in an indirect way. But in one of these texts, this Taoist text called the Zhuangzi, the author is talking about the Taoist sage, and he compares the Taoist sage to a drunken person who is kind of oblivious about what's going on around him. And so he falls out of his cart and he's not hurt because he's relaxed. And so he rolls with it. He doesn't tense up. And it's clear that in the story, it's meant as a metaphor, because Zhuangzi says at the end, if you can keep your spirit whole in this way by means of alcohol, how much more so could you do it if you're drunk on heaven instead? He wants you to be drunk on the spiritual force, not on alcohol. But that story made me start to think, yeah, but alcohol is not a bad shortcut. If you're not, if you don't have heaven yet, you know, wine's not a bad substitute. And so it made me start thinking about how cultures might be using alcohol and other chemical intoxicants as a cultural technology to get around this cognitive paradox. They want you to get it. They want you to be spontaneous in certain situations because it's useful. It's helpful. There's a direct paradox of how you try not to try. One solution is just drink this substance that just reaches directly inside your brain and shuts that part down for you. You don't have to try to shut it down. And so that's what made me start to think about why cultures use alcohol and how it may be serving a really important function. And that's why we have it.
So, okay. Is it pronounced uwe? Uwe?
Uwe.
Uwe?
W-U-wei.
Right.
Uwe.
I mean, it's in your book and I've heard you say that, but I can't.
Yeah.
So uwe. So I want to actually just go back to that and talk not about drinking or intoxication yet. I think this is really fascinating. So I study just Western stuff. I mean, I think I taught Confucius once or twice. That is the extent of my knowledge, really, of Eastern philosophy. And I meditate. That's about it.
Okay.
So, and right away, when you describe Uwe and the fact that philosophers, according to you, in China, I guess, and other parts of Asia as well, have actually sought that as the goal, right? Mm-hmm. To produce that in people.
Yeah.
That is not a Western idea. Certainly not an American kind of idea, right? We don't historically in the West, in Europe and the United States, I know for sure, you know, that's the kind of thing I think Westerners just haven't been interested in doing and might even be a little bit antagonistic toward, because it sounds so. Can you describe it though? I want to make sure I get this right. So it's not just spontaneity, right? It's sort of like being in the zone, like in sports, maybe.
The best analogy would be being in the zone in sports, or being a stand-up comic who's really killing it. You know, every joke is landing perfectly and you're coming up with new material on the fly and people love your act. Everything's going great. It's like a fantastic first date or job interview where you, for whatever reason, you're completely relaxed. You're not worried about it. And that's why you are able to be charismatic and successful.
So it's about creativity, right?
It's about creativity. It's about trust. So people trust you more. People like you more. So they actually, the Chinese actually have a word for this power that you have when you're in Wei. Unfortunately, it's pronounced duh in modern Mandarin, but it's D-E. But it's, you know, charismatic virtue is maybe one way to translate it, or even just charismatic power. But you have this power over people because they like you and they trust you, and they want to, if you're a Confucian ruler, they want to follow you. They want to obey you without you having to ask or compel them to do it. If you're a Taoist sage, you kind of, like if you're a Zhuangzian sage, the effect of your duh is to relax people around you. So they get freed of their hangups because you're so relaxed, they become relaxed. And it's, there's this kind of contagion of spiritual perfection that happens in the Zhuangzi.
Yeah. Relaxation, creativity, charisma. You will not find, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you're a professor of philosophy, but you won't really find a Western philosopher seeking that or even promoting it or even suggesting ways to achieve it, because Western philosophers from Plato onward generally have been interested in things like work, productivity, social order, people doing their functions, serving particular functions, being socially useful, being socially useful, right? Does that make sense? I mean, I'm just struck by this. I hadn't even thought of this before you mentioned it just now, but
there's definitely a difference. So one way to think about it is that, and again, these are broad brush strokes. So I mean, my last academic book was trying to break down what I call neo-Orientalism and kind of overly simplistic, totalizing views of the East versus the West.
But
you can make some generalizations in the sense of talking about general trends. So there's always exceptions in both groups of philosophers, but one generalization you can defend maybe is the Chinese tend to be more interested in, if you want to use Gilbert Ryle's distinction between knowing how and knowing that, mm-hmm. the Chinese are interested in know-how. They're interested in skill and how to move through the world skillfully. Right. So their model of knowledge is more like a skill. Whereas Western philosophers tend to focus more on knowing that, having abstract propositional knowledge about the world, representing the world accurately. And you see this then reflected in models of ethics, where you get in the West, eventually, I mean, there are virtue ethicists in the West. I mean, Aristotle is very different from Plato. Aristotle in some ways looks more like the Chinese philosophers like Confucius than Plato does. But, you know, you want to talk about modern Western philosophy. So post-Enlightenment thought, it's very much based on disembodied rationality and, you know, either maxims, following certain maxims, you know, Kantian deontology, or you're utilitarian and you're calculating the cost benefits and doing the math. And there was an early Chinese utilitarian named Mozi, and he was a classic utilitarian. But for whatever reason, he lost out. That utilitarianism never took off in China. And what won out was a form of virtue ethics, where ethics is about developing habits, skillful habits or emotional dispositions that cause you to spontaneously act in a certain way without you having to exert conscious effort. And so they're valuing spontaneous virtue and kind of unself-conscious goodness over conscious willed forced action, which is really the opposite of someone like Kant. So Kant thought an action wasn't moral unless you consciously chose to do it in accordance with the law.
The West has been interested in, as you said, rationalism. Right. It's, logic, rationality, functionality, utilitarianism. I feel like in my reading of Western philosophy that things like spontaneity and creativity are feared because they're always, as I said, like it's not just the Western philosophers, but then the application of their ideas by, you know, states and leaders, political leaders, right? it's the kind of thing that most political leaders, certainly in this country, have not been promoting, at least formally. I mean, they do it in private, but they don't, they fear that because they're afraid of people being individualistic, I suppose. I mean, it's a, you know, we talk a good game about freedom here, but actually it's really a particular kinds of freedom that we value. And I'm amazed that social leaders anywhere would actually want to promote creativity and spontaneity among the people, because it's harder to control them.
Yeah. Right? And I'm not sure that's even what was happening in China. So we have these Chinese philosophers who are advocating these things.
Yeah.
When Confucianism becomes the state religion, essentially, it looks a little different. I'm not sure it's exactly the vision that Confucius, the historical Confucius, would have had, or Mencius, certainly. Mm. So I think some of what you're talking about is just a function of states. Once you get states, they want to control their citizens in certain ways. And certainly, I mean, China, the first emperor of Qin, was not a touchy-feely, let everyone be spontaneous kind of guy.
Of course.
He was, you know, executing people and making sure the roads were uniform with, and the coinage was unified. And so, I mean, it's funny because, you know, China was unified through this very kind of pretty vicious and rational legalism. Is what we call the school. And then Confucianism kind of comes back, but it then takes advantage of all the structures that were put into place by legalism. And so the public moral discourse is often Confucian, but the way the state runs is because of these institutions that were set up by legalists. So it's a weird hybrid. And the way Confucianism is being used now in modern China is very much as a way of justifying, you know, the rule of the Communist Party and submission to authority and Chinese nationalism. Right. So it's a complicated story.
Absolutely. No, it becomes an instrument of control in the hands of the state. Yeah, for sure. But I find that just very interesting. And it just sort of speaks to how repression is more central in Western thinking, maybe.
Certainly repression. Yeah. So control, another way to think about the difference is that, so to kind of segue into when we start talking about alcohol, the prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain that's in charge of self-control. It's the part that stays focused on tasks, suppresses emotions that are unhelpful, allows you to control impulses, stay free of distractions. If you want to, one way to think of it is Western ethics tends to be PFC centered, to be all about cognitive control and rationality. Whereas the forms of early Chinese philosophy that I'm interested in that become the dominant schools were about loosening the hold of the PFC in various ways. For them, the ideal way of acting was not purely PFC based. And if you were actually exerting self-control, that meant there's something wrong with you. Like you weren't fully virtuous.
Wow.
Because a truly virtuous person does it spontaneously, unselfconsciously, naturally.
Wow.
So yeah, that's another way to put it, is that the Chinese were valuing a form of behavior that's not fully under the control of the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And illuminating. So the prefrontal cortex is where I think Freud would say the superego resides. I mean, I don't think they hadn't identified the PFC back in the 1920s when he was around, but right. I mean, it's the controlling part that the social order actually values, because the social, or the state, especially civilization, which is also where, you know, prefiguring the conversation here, but that's where civilization resides, the demands, the dictates of civilization. It keeps you in order. It keeps you on task, keeps you doing, serving your proper function, as Plato wanted us to do.
Yeah. It also is the sphere of the ego, though. So the ego that's dealing with reality and the demands of reality. Mm-hmm. You know, the ego's in Freud's model, as you know, is kind of the go-between the id and the both the superego and the external world,
right?
Trying to get what the id wants. In accordance with the reality principle, right? We've got to deal with limitations, and then we got to deal with the superego, which has got other demands. So the PFC is also what's doing that. It's the mm-hmm. one that's trying to keep us it's instrumental reason is seated yes. there as well. So I think the problem with Freud's model is he doesn't really have a picture of a kind of PFC transformed spontaneity. So for him, spontaneity is all just the id.
Mm-hmm.
And it's animalistic, it's crude, it's unchanging, it always wants what it wants.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why he's fun. I teach Freud as kind of a counterpart as what is like the wrong view of what civilization's about.
Oh, really?
As opposed to the Confucian. So I teach a class on comparative conceptions of the self where I pit Freud against Xunzi, this Confucian thinker, because they have very similar views of human nature. They start from the same place, but in Freud's model, because the id never changes, that's why we're always going to be discontented, right? We're always going to be unbehagen mm-hmm. mm-hmm. because we're never going to get, the id's always going to want unrestrained satisfaction. Right. And it's just not realistic. We're never going to get that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always going to be a little bit dissatisfied. Right. We're going to have to sublimate, and getting a sublimated desire satisfied is never as good as getting the original one satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really tragic, it's a very tragic view of humans and civilization.
Totally.
And I think really pessimistic.
Yeah.
I think the better way to look at it, the Confucian way to look at it, is you can actually transform, to use Freudian language, you can transform the id. You can take spontaneous tendencies and reshape them. And they become then new types of desires that actually fit with civilization. And so then if you can do that reshaping process, then you have a situation where you can basically indulge your id and yet be a moral, ethical member of society because your desires have been transformed.
Okay. And would desire to drink and be intoxicated be one of those? This is the argument of your book, of course, is that it's both a problem for civilization, drinking, but it's also, you argue, fundamental in the formation of civilizations.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got a lot of functions. So clearly, you know, it gives us pleasure. That's like, you know, we're motivated to drink because it's pleasurable.
Right.
And so the basic question of the book, Drunk, is, you know, why do we like to get drunk? And the simple answer is, well, because it makes us feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And people have been satisfied with that answer for a really long time. I find it unsatisfying because it just pushes the question back.
Mm-hmm.
Why does evolution allow it to make us feel good? Given how incredibly harmful it is. It's incredibly harmful physiologically. It's mm-hmm. extremely costly,
mm-hmm.
just in terms of material resources, in terms of disorder, social disorder, alcoholism, all the bad things that come with alcohol. Evolution could have eliminated it from our motivation system. So there are existing genetic mutations in the human gene pool that make alcohol not make you feel good. So there's a set of two mutations that mess with our metabolism of ethanol that have arisen at least three times independently around the world. The one that's best known comes from East Asia and sometimes called the Asian Flushing syndrome.
Right.
So if you have the set of mutations, you have a little bit of alcohol, you turn red, you get heart palpitations, you feel nauseous. Alcohol doesn't make you feel good. You don't like to drink. It looks like that set of genes evolved, this mutation happened 7,000 to 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been around for a really long time. And yet it hasn't really gone anywhere. It's pretty much stayed confined to small parts of East Asia. And so, you know, sometimes there are problems that evolution would like to solve, but can't solve because the mutation doesn't exist. Or it can't get to that mutation because of path dependence. You know, there's kind of like our backs suck, but that's because evolution was stuck with a tree living primate and then had to make us walk upright. It didn't have the luxury of redesigning us from the ground up. But in the case of alcohol, this is not the case. We have a very good solution to if alcohol, as we've been taught, as the standard scientific story goes, is just a kind of hijack of pleasure centers in our brain. There's a way to fix that, and it's been around for a long time, and yet it hasn't taken off. And that suggests that in addition to the costs that alcohol imposes on us, there are lots of benefits, and those are paying for the costs. And that's why the taste for alcohol has remained in the gene pool. Okay. So we have this taste for alcohol. It gives us pleasure, but the reason it's allowed to continue to give us pleasure is because it's doing something for us as both individuals and as a species, I think. Okay. So that's what the bulk of the book is about, is trying to lay out what those benefits might be.
Take it from me. Dating apps suck. I've been on a few lately. There are the superficial face swiping apps, and then there are the so-called expert matching apps, and both usually waste my time. The solution is values-based matching. If you're not a leftist, things probably aren't going to work out with someone who's a hardcore lefty, which is what I find here in the Bay Area, and I'm sure many of you find in other places in the country as well. Same with religion, lifestyle, how to raise children, and other core values. Sure, anybody might change to meet you where you are, but why not just find the perfect match off the bat? Drom is a free, new, values-based dating app. You pick deal breakers and deal makers. As soon as someone matches your deal breakers and deal makers, and you match theirs, you get a notification. There aren't any experts or match percentages, and you don't have to addictively check the app. If you don't find a deal breaker or deal maker that's important to you, you can add your own for everyone to see, and it's private and anonymous. Drom is also video only for more human interactions. Go to drom.date/$code in your phone's browser. Click the iOS or Google button to install and use the invite code $code to sign up. That's drom.date/$code. Drom, design and meet your perfect match. It's free to use.
Right. Okay. We're going to do that for sure. But I didn't let you answer the question. So,
okay, yeah.
So which was, you were starting to, and then we digressed. So from, how'd you get from Uwe to wanting to study drinking?
Well, that story in the Zhuangzi about the drunken man made me think, this could be a useful tool. So you've got the problem you have as a society is I want people to be spontaneous in this situation. Mm-hmm. The problem is if you say to people, be spontaneous, they won't be spontaneous, right? It's counterproductive. Right. If you just sit them down though and give them some beers, they're going to become spontaneous because the chemical is getting the effect you want. It's turning down the PFC. And so I just started thinking about alcohol as a cultural technology. Mm. I also, my other main area of research in the past decade or so has been cognitive science and evolution of religion. Mm. And that's motivated by this basic question of my PhD is in religious studies. And in religious studies, we tend to study, how people have been religious, what the history of religions are around the world, what different forms they take. We very rarely step back and say, why are people religious in the first place?
Yes.
And again, from an evolutionary perspective, this is super puzzling because you would think that, so it's incredibly, being religious is incredibly costly. You're cutting off the foreskin of your penis, you're scarifying yourself, mm-hmm. you're sitting in boring ceremonies on Sunday when you could be out gardening, doing something useful. Mm-hmm. You are sacrificing food and valuable objects to invisible entities. You have cultures who are, their biggest, half their gross national product goes into, in right. China, goes into these massive terracotta armies that get buried. They just get buried underground, right? So it's puzzling because you would think that, first of all, an individual who instead of, cutting off the foreskin of his penis and avoiding pork, delicious, nutritious food stuff, indulged in pork and kept his foreskin intact and didn't risk infection, would do better than someone who did it. And you would think that cultures that instead of building fake terracotta armies in the ground, built real armies or, you know, improved their mm-hmm. irrigation systems or did something actually useful, you would think they would outcompete groups that go in for waste on this massive scale. Because it is waste. I mean, from a scientific perspective, there's no gods who are going to, you know, help you out because you did this thing. Mm-hmm. And so religion is a mystery hiding in plain sight, in the sense that we take it for granted that everywhere we go, people are worshiping invisible beings, they're observing rituals that these beings want them to observe. They're building, we're not surprised when we go to a new culture and the largest monuments we find are ones dedicated to non-instrumental religious purposes. And yet it should puzzle us.
Yeah.
And I think, so another route into this topic was that I came to view chemical intoxicants as very similar to religion in that regard. We take it for granted that everywhere we go, people are getting high on something. They're drinking some sort of alcohol, or they're, you know, doing mushrooms, or they're smoking tobacco that's laced with hallucinogens. And it's just like, oh, of course you do that. You go, you know, travelers, European travelers, they arrive at a new place and they're greeted with intoxicants of some kind in mm-hmm. a ceremony. Of course, that's how it goes. We never step back and say, well, why? Why is it so ubiquitous? Mm-hmm. Why is it so ancient? And why hasn't it been eliminated by either genetic or cultural evolution, given how costly it is?
Right.
Because chemical intoxicants are almost as costly as religion.
Yeah.
And yet they're still around. So.
And what's the
answer? That was the other route.
What's the answer?
The answer is that they're both serving functions.
Yeah. Okay.
Hidden right. functions that we don't always appreciate.
Right. Okay. Which is the argument
so,
in your book.
So
right.
So the cultures that build big, stupid, useless monuments get cohesion and get buy-in from people that allow them to outcompete groups that don't do that. cutting off the foreskin of your penis exposes you to infection. It's also a really effective signal to your buddy that you take this religion seriously. and you're not going to change your mind because there's no going back, right? And scarification and tattoos serve the same function. All of these things serve signaling and trust enhancing functions.
Okay.
And alcohol is doing some of that same stuff as well.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Tremendously socially inefficient, both religion and alcohol on the one hand, but I guess you're saying there are efficiencies in both.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So there, religion, we have one of my arguments in the book is that humans face cooperation dilemmas all the time. Mm-hmm. When we're living in large scale societies, I often have to cooperate with you in a situation where I don't know you, you're a stranger. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to have to trust that you're going to cooperate with me. And if I can do that, we're both going to do better. So these situations are called, in game theory, they're called prisoner's dilemma situations, or sometimes tragedy of the commons has a similar structure,
right?
Where the best payoff is one where we cooperate and trust each other.
Right.
But we're often doing that in situations where we can't verify that the other person's going to actually cooperate. Mm-hmm. And how do we get past those dilemmas? One way is religion. So how do I know I can trust you? Because you have a tattoo of Ra on your forehead, mm-hmm. and you mm-hmm. wouldn't have done that unless you really believe in Ra. Mm-hmm. And so I know that you believe in this God that I believe in, and we can, therefore we're buddies. And you're gonna be serious about it because if you really believe in Ra, you believe Ra is gonna punish you if you don't cooperate with me. So it's a way of signaling that I'm really a part of your group and you can trust me. And alcohol is serving a similar function. So how do I know I can trust you? We're gonna sit down and turn our prefrontal cortices all the way down to the point that you can't lie anymore. So one function of alcohol is to downregulate the PFC.
Yep.
What that means is it's very difficult to lie. You lose your working memory. Well, lying is cognitively very taxing, right? Yeah. You've got to keep in your mind both what reality is and what you say reality is. You've got to suppress inappropriate emotions. Mm-hmm. So someone tells you something unfortunate that's actually secretly something that you are happy about, you've got to suppress that reaction. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of it. Your PFC has got to be running at peak performance to lie successfully to another mm-hmm. person. Mm-hmm. If I give you a bunch of alcohol, you're going to have trouble doing that.
Right.
That's more intuitive. What's maybe a little counterintuitive is that you're actually a better lie detector when you're drunk. And that's because we think we know how to detect lying, but we don't. So when we're consciously trying to, you know, whatever, we saw something in a Sherlock Holmes story about, you know, when they look to the left, they're lying. So we're like looking at your eyes as you look to the left, it's useless. You're going to do less than chance if you're trying to detect lies. When you turn the PFC down, you're just taking in a broader bandwidth of information. I'm not looking at anything in particular. I'm taking in broadly your facial expressions, your tone of voice, your body language. I'm more open. My sensory channels are more open to more information.
Yeah.
And that's probably why we're better at lie detecting when we're inebriated. When you introduce alcohol to a social situation, you've impaired the ability of people to lie or cheat. You've enhanced the ability of people to detect lying and cheating. You've also, at the same time, you're ramping up endorphins and serotonins, which just makes you less inclined to want to cheat. It makes you feel more generous and more pro-social and more inclined to cooperate. So it's a great tool for building social cooperation and trust. And so that's one of the functions that alcohol is performing.
Fascinating. I almost cursed. That was so fascinating. The prefrontal cortex, as we said earlier, its function in part is to repress certain mm-hmm. feelings and thoughts, right? And so by repressing things, you're becoming a better worker or whatever, but you're also missing information, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so interesting. Right. Makes perfect sense to me too.
So that's one of the main functions, is that trust building one, trust enhancing one. Mm-hmm. Another problem the PFC causes, this kind of being focused, being self-controlled, mm-hmm. is it makes you really bad at creativity tasks. So mm-hmm. tasks where you don't just have to go from A to B to C, you actually have to think laterally and make an insight. So there are lots of problems that can't be solved algorithmically through kind of churning through the math of it. You've got to just have an aha kind of moment where you see the connection between things. When your PFC is functioning at full bore, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. You're focused on algorithmic reasoning. And so people with impaired PFCs, for whatever reason, strokes or just congenital brain damage, they're better at creativity tasks than mm-hmm. people with functioning PFCs. Kids are great at creativity tasks, and their performance decreases in a linear fashion as they age, exactly tracking the maturation of the prefrontal cortex. If you zap someone's PFC with a transcranial magnet, they for a little bit do better on creativity tasks. So the PFC is the enemy of creativity.
Yeah.
And humans need creativity because we're completely dependent as a species on creativity. We are useless and helpless without tools and technology. So much so that our bodies have become adapted to technology. Like our digestive systems and our teeth can't deal with raw food anymore. I don't know if raw foodies have gotten the memo on this, but you can't live on raw food anymore. We've adapted to fire. We have to eat cooked food because our intestinal system is too short to really extract nutrients unless they get pre-digested essentially by fire. Hmm. So we're completely dependent, and we're not born with fire. You know, a baby dropped in the wilderness doesn't have matches, right? You have to figure out how to make fire. So we're dependent on technology in this way that makes us dependent on creativity. And evolution's had this problem where it, like, we need a PFC. We need to be able to get up in the morning and do A, B, and C and stay on task. But how to square that with the fact that that interferes with creativity? One way to solve that problem is to, again, use a substance to temporarily dial the PFC back. And you can, if you do that for 2 or 3 hours, you have the mental flexibility again of a 4 or 5 year old, but you're also a grown up. So you know what's important and you're not using that creativity to, you know, make a stupid Lego fort or do, you know, tear heads off of dolls and put them on other dolls. That's what kids do, which is fun for them. And, but we want people figuring out how to solve COVID and, you know, climate change. And adults know what those problems are. And so they have adult knowledge and adult motivational systems. But then if they drink a little bit of alcohol, they can regain some of that cognitive flexibility again. And so I argue in the book that it's been used historically as a tool for enhancing creativity.
Okay. So Freud is wrong in that he did not believe that things like, well, creativity and spontaneity, things associated with what he calls the id, he thinks they were not useful for civilization. And you're arguing that they're essential for civilization. Essential.
Yeah.
And that's, we're going to tell this, you're going to tell the story in a second about that. But and so, wow, I'm just sort of reeling from this because I've been a Freudian my whole life on this one question.
Okay.
So I'm now thinking about the politics of it, right? Because for me, it's, you know, as a Freudian on this question, it's always been sort of like this epic eternal struggle between the masters of civilization and order, right? On the one hand, and then on the other hand, the id and the people, you know, and the people who are, you know, more of the body of the id, who are less controlled, who are more spontaneous, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And those people tend to be artists and musicians and drug addicts and drunks. Right. And that's sort of my book, Renegade History, is about, it's exactly that. My book is about the United States, the history of the United States, and how that battle has taken place over hundreds of years. And I mean, that battle has taken place. I mean, it's not completely wrong, this model, but this is nuance here that I'm trying to grapple with and trying to figure out what this means.
So what's your story? So what happens?
Well, so, I mean, it's just
superego heroes win. Is that
it's an ongoing conflict. I call it the eternal civil war, right?
Okay.
So, you know, you get the Puritans, they come here and they're all, of course, they're famously about repression and control, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one guy from the colony, Plymouth colony, goes off and founds this basically what sort of a hippie basically colony, where they like dance and fornicate with the Indians and drink a lot and dance around the Maypole. And of course, what do they do? What do the Puritans do? They find out about this and they establish the very first militia in America and go stomp it into the ground and put everybody in prison and kill the Indians.
Yeah.
And then, but you know, you just see it all the time, right? I mean, and so that's just, to me, I said that's the beginning of this eternal civil war in the United States.
Okay.
Where, and this is undoubtedly true. You see like forces of repression constantly fighting against what we would call the id or the body or, you know, spontaneity, creativity, right? So, you know, look at the history of rock and roll. That's a really classic, easy example, right? You know, it comes along in the 1940s and 1950s. And there's this mass freak out among people who literally say, specifically, John F. Kennedy said this in the Senate. He said, this will bring down American civilization.
Right.
Right. Because
so are you influenced by Dancing in the Streets, Barbara Ehrenreich's book? Yeah.
I wrote my book, I think, after hers came out. But yeah, it was, I mean, it's sort of consistent with her on that. Yeah.
Well, she puts it as this battle between Apollo and Dionysus, right?
Yeah,
so this kind of Apollonian order versus Dionysian ecstasy.
Right.
And she sees it as this kind of story of Apollo winning, you know, kind of driving pleasure out of the world. Yeah.
No, no one's, according to me, no one has won.
Although
I would say that Dionysus, I think the tide moves in that favor. It's, you know, if you look at especially like very authoritarian regimes, you know, like the Soviet Union, right? The Soviet Union what happened there? I mean, Joe Stalin himself said, we cannot allow jazz and rock and roll and blue jeans in here because it's going to, you know, cause the people to go off and be Americans and give up on communism, you know, and who won, right? Yeah. Rock and roll won. So so what do you want to do? What would you do with that narrative? How would you?
Well, it reflects a real tension in humans, right? Between the PFC and the other forces itself. And the PFC is important. Like there's a really, it's super expensive organ. We wouldn't have evolved it unless it was useful.
Wouldn't we starve to death if we didn't have it?
Yeah, no, we would be like four-year-olds, right? Sure. And four-year-olds can't feed themselves. So we need it. But again, it can't do everything on its own. It can't innovate.
Right.
It can't solve cooperation dilemmas.
Right.
And that's where we need the Dionysian element. And you know, so I argue in the book at one point, the way I put it is, you know, it's not the case that, you know, Apollo is the founder of civilization. It's Dionysus who dragged Apollo into civilization.
Okay.
Because it's people were motivated to settle down and start large-scale societies by the desire to get drunk. And so this is, you know, the standard story we were told is agriculture was invented.
Right.
And then by accident, at some point, we discovered that if we left stuff around, bread-making stuff around, it would ferment. But that seems to not be the case. The archaeological evidence suggests that hunter-gatherers were getting together, having these elaborate religious rituals, building monumental religious sites, and getting really wasted thousands of years before agriculture started. And that probably it's that motivation to make more and better beer that motivated them to settle down and start domesticating grains than the other way around. And so, you know, in that sense, Dionysus directly gave rise to civilization. Yeah. And then for civilizations to be successful, you need that Dionysian element present. Right. And this is actually a good example why Western philosophy isn't completely, you know, it's not completely foreign to Western philosophy. You know, Nietzsche is the one who really.
Sure. He's the exception. Right.
Thematized this tension between Apollo and Dionysus and celebrated Dionysus. Right.
Right.
Yeah. So the argument in the book is that there has to be a place for Dionysus. This idea that you could have pure Apollonian order, if you want to put it that way, is a myth, because a purely Apollonian society would be rigid. It would be rigid. It couldn't innovate and it would fall apart because people wouldn't be able to trust and cooperate with one another.
Okay. So the history that you do in the book, I like it. It's mostly persuasive, but I don't see, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't see any real clear evidence of the causal link. So I see that drinking and intoxication happened before civilization, before the advent of civilization, but I don't see any real proof or evidence that one led to the other, that drinking intoxication led directly to civilization. Is there?
There's good evidence that the first domesticated crops were chosen for their psychoactive properties, not for their nutrition properties. And this is a pattern you see around the world. So in South America, the wild ancestor of maize is teosinte.
Right.
Teosinte makes shitty grain. Mm-hmm. So if you were a hunter-gatherer and you were mainly motivated by hunger, and you want a better nutrition, you would ignore this plant because it doesn't make very good food products. What it does make is really good beer. Mm-hmm. And so in that, it's got to be the case that hunter-gatherers focused on this crop and started, you know, getting it to produce bigger grains and be more productive because they wanted to make chicha. They wanted to make the maize-based beer that they make in South America. Mm. And then they must have discovered that, once the grains get bigger, you can also make tortillas. You know, you can actually make food out of it too.
Okay.
So given just the relative qualities of, same thing is true with the wild grains that were cultivated in the Fertile Crescent. They seem to be better suited to beer making than to bread making in their wild forms. you see in North America, to the extent that agriculture got off the ground, let's say, in, you know, what we think of now as the Northeast United States, they're cultivating tobacco. They're cultivating a psychoactive crop that they're mixing with hallucinogens to produce an intoxicating smoke that served basically all the same functions that alcohol served in other cultures. So the evidence is that it seems clear that the motivation for starting agriculture was to get better and more psychoactive substances. And then we notice that, oh yeah, it also, we can make bread out of it.
What a slander on civilization, Professor Slingerland. I mean, what are you saying here?
Yeah. Well, it says a lot. I mean, I think it's revealing and I think it's important. And it also just, you know, we have to, because of this Puritanism, this Apollonian kind of control strain that takes this weird form in America because of Puritanism, right, we're uncomfortable giving any positive role to intoxication.
Right? Exactly. Right.
We ignore it. I point out that in the scholarship in my field, so in religious studies and cognitive science of religion, when we talk about rituals, so rituals around the world or historically, we focus on synchrony, singing, dancing, maybe, you know, pain, how people use pain in rituals. No one ever talks about the fact that everyone doing this stuff is wasted.
Exactly.
Right? We're really uncomfortable talking about the fact that people are using chemical intoxicants in these contexts. And so I think that we just have this huge blind spot. We talk about alcohol to the extent we do from a purely medicalized perspective. If you look at the scientific study, if you look at psychological literature on alcohol, it's almost all addiction studies.
You know,
it's all medicalized studies of alcoholism. To the extent that social psychologists study alcohol, it's about the role of alcohol in abuse, sexual abuse, and, you know, other types of social disorders. There's almost no literature on alcohol and anything other than pathology.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
And that's messed up. It's because of this prejudice. And I think that there's, you know, again, I look at the bit of evidence there is coming out of psychology for the creative function, the bonding function. There is a small bit of literature on this. And that's what I review this in the book. But I think we've been hampered by the fact that our public policy, if you're an individual trying to decide, you know, should alcohol have a role in my life? If you're an organization deciding, should alcohol have a role in our organizational life? You know, should we have alcohol at our office party? Should we let professors take their grad students out for beers after the graduate seminar is over? Our decision-making process is completely based on just risks and, you know, minimizing risk and not seeing any positive benefit other than fun, which, you know, gets zero weight if you're doing cost benefit analysis.
Yep.
And so I'm just trying to get people to see if we are actually going to have a sophisticated scientific anthropological attitude towards alcohol, we've got to see the positive functions.
I love it.
And it may be the case that at the end of the day, you still say you can't mix professors and students and alcohol. That may be your intelligent, considered decision as a university administrator.
Yeah.
But in making that decision, you have to be clear about what you're giving up, because you would be giving some stuff up, important functions up.
If you want some CBD, and many, many people do these days because it helps with so many problems that we have, with anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, aches and pains in our body, you gotta go to only one place, which is Paloma Verde CBD. That has been the main sponsor of the Unregistered Podcast for more than a year now. And the quality of the products and the deal we get, especially from Paloma Verde, has built an incredible relationship between us, the unregistered community, and this wonderful company that's owned and operated by Carlos and Vanessa Abelar out of San Antonio, Texas. So you get 25% off every single product in their store by going to palomaverdecbd.com and using the discount code RENEGADE. 25% off everything. You simply won't find that kind of deal from other CBD companies. Also, when you're there, check out the Unregistered Combo Pack. That's my three favorite products in one bundle. You get their delicious, amazing fruit-flavored gummies that I love so much and eat them all the time, as you can tell. 10 milligrams of CBD in each gummy. Their soft gels, 25 milligrams of CBD in each one. I take 2 to 6 of these every day, depending on how my mood is. And my favorite thing, their high-potency, fast-acting tincture. You put some drops under your tongue, and I promise you, you're going to feel better almost right away. They also have this brand-new product that I'm so excited about. It's a hybrid melatonin-CBD soft gel. Check that out as well. The Unregistered Combo Pack, which includes those three products I mentioned earlier, that's 33% off. It's also called the Thad Pack if you want to be cool. So again, go to palomaverdecbd.com, use the discount code RENEGADE, make your body feel better, make your life better, and I thank you.
So that's all I want to do is have a more balanced discussion of the role of Dionysus in civilization.
You're trying to resolve this conflict between the id and the superego, right?
It's a false conflict, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So the founding fathers in the 18th century, they say, hey, we want to let the people rule, you know, many people, whatever.
Yeah. Some people. Yeah. So then white landowning males.
Yeah, yeah. But then they expanded that, you know, it was a democratic move essentially. Right.
Yeah.
And then they said, oh my God, these people are all drunks, because I'm sure, you know, I know, you know, that in early America, the drinking was off the chain here. I mean, it was just incredible. The numbers of the quarts of alcohol that were consumed in a day by everyone. And then Benjamin Rush was considered like the founding doctor. He's one of the founding fathers because he's a doctor, right? What does he do? As soon as the revolution happens and the new republic is established, he writes books and articles about this thing he calls, that becomes known as alcoholism. And he says that alcohol, there's this thing that it's a biological condition, and people who have it can never get rid of it, that it's a permanent state that we alcoholics, and I am technically an alcoholic, I've been sober for 8 years, but that we will. And I was told when I started to, you know, go into AA and figure out what to do with my drinking, that was the absolute rule, right? It's just, oh, this is your thing forever, and the only cure for it, or the only remedy for it, is to never drink again.
Right.
And it's amazing. This is Benjamin Rush in the 18th century, who didn't have a microscope, who couldn't see, you know, into my body.
You know,
he also didn't ask me any questions, you know, about so it was based purely on, you know, observing a few drunks in Philadelphia in 1780 and then writing this speculative stuff about, oh, well, yeah, this is so. And the founding fathers loved it, of course.
Yeah.
And they started to punish drunks, and they started to put drunks in prisons and reformatories immediately. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, as you said, not a single positive word has been said about drinking or intoxication by any government leader, anybody, any educator, any administrator, any general, any major businessman, right? It's always been, this is dangerous at best, drinking.
Right. Yeah.
And so I would ask you, if I'm a university administrator or the president of the United States, or let's make it even harder, a general in the US military, right? What are you telling me I should do? In terms of, what should I say to the people about whether they should drink or not?
Yeah. Well, George Washington petitioned Congress to establish distilleries so that his troops could have alcohol.
Oh,
he thought that alcohol was crucial to
because they were mutinous. They were rebelling against him and, you know, threatening to overthrow him. But, and he knew he had to do that because otherwise they would have overthrown him.
A sop to his troops, but he couched it in terms of morale, It helps with the morale of troops.
Well, George Washington, he hanged a whole bunch of his own troops.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
They were very mutinous. Yes. So,
yeah. So what I would say, so to modern day, if you're a university administrator, is, you know, all the downsides are clear, right? You allow alcohol on campus and a student gets sexually assaulted. Someone gets sexually harassed. Mm-hmm. It's lawsuits. I mean, university administrators see only lawsuits. And so again, if you don't have any positive role for alcohol, the choice is clear. It's just, let's be dry. And that's the way things are moving, I think. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What I would say to them is see the things you're giving up. So, you know, I talk in the book about this big grant for the evolution of religion that we got. We got the first of these big partnership grants that the federal government in Canada had started at UBC. This was back in 2012. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced that grant wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had a pub built on campus. So there's no place to drink on campus. And then they built this pub right next to the bus loop, which was convenient. So kind of everyone on their way out of campus would pass by this pub. And so me and some colleagues started meeting there on Friday afternoons and just no agenda, just shooting the shit, drinking some beers. And a $3 million 6-year grant came out of that, and an award-winning paper, and this database project that I still run now, that has at this point gotten about $11 million in grant money for.
Wow.
There's things happen, and none of this would have happened, I'm convinced, if that had been a coffee shop instead of a pub. Mm-hmm. Because what happens when people sit down with the right amount of alcohol, and the right amount of alcohol is not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. It's enough. It's like two drinks. You want to get to about 0.08 BAC. Okay. Seems to be the sweet spot for most of the effects of alcohol, the creativity enhancement, the social enhancement. You're more creative individually. You're also disinhibited. And so, you know, I was telling people who are world renowned experts in their fields what I thought about their field. You know, it was like, this is what I think about cultural evolution, to Joe Hendrick, who's like one of the main figures in cultural evolution. You're only going to do that two beers in, because otherwise you'd risk sounding stupid, right? But you say things that you would normally repress, and maybe for good reason. So maybe, you know, 9 times out of 10, they are stupid or misinformed, but then that 1 time out of 10 they're not, there may be something that other person would have never thought of before. And so connections get made, people share knowledge in an open way. Group creativity, I think, crucially depends on alcohol. And there's there's not a lot of good causal evidence here. I do cite one study that is correlational, but it's taking advantage of a natural experiment. So this economist looked at this natural experiment of prohibition in the US, and the fact that, you know, prohibition, as you know, was imposed piecemeal over a long period of time at the county level. And so he took advantage of that natural variation to look at counties that were wet and then became dry. And he used patent applications registered in that county as a proxy for innovation. And he found that when prohibition gets imposed, patent applications go down 15%.
Wow.
And they don't rebound for 3 years. And he thinks what's happening after 3 years is speakeasies start to take over the role that saloons did before prohibition. So that's correlational, but it suggests that there's something to kind of group people getting together in public and gently downregulating the prefrontal cortices that is crucial for innovation. And then you see successful organizations using it. So I talk about my visit to Google, where I talked about spontaneity and creativity. Mm-hmm. And then the first place they took me on my campus tour was the whiskey room, where when they run into a coding problem and Apollo is no longer their friend, because sitting in front of the computer screen trying to pound their way through this problem is not helping, they go to their whiskey room and pour themselves a glass of whiskey and sit in beanbag chairs and let Dionysus take over for a little bit. Huh. And often that gives them, that breaks the logjam. You know, it allows them to think laterally and come up with solutions they wouldn't come up with otherwise. So you see successful organizations using it. You see around the world throughout time, artists and poets, creative types, you know, extolling the value of intoxicants, because people have always known this intuitively. They've known it experientially.
Mm-hmm. That's the bomb. What is it? The Balmer effect?
The Balmer Peak. Yeah.
Balmer Peak. Yeah. Steve Balmer.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, maybe apocryphal, but that's what, so that same visit to Google, the first Q&A person said, hey, have you heard of the Balmer Peak? And, you know, it's supposedly that Steve Ballmer, the former CEO of Microsoft, discovered that there was this very narrow blood alcohol content where he became a supernaturally good coder. It was like coding was like, okay. And then at this blood alcohol content, he was great. And then it fell off again really sharply. And so he supposedly kept himself hooked up to an IV of alcohol to keep himself right at that BAC level, which, you know,
no
is
way.
That true? I don't know. Unlikely. But it captures this idea that I was told this in response to a study I showed where people's creativity peaks at 0.08 BAC and then goes down. And you see similar curves for all sorts of things that require lateral thinking, spontaneity. Mm-hmm. I speak several languages. Okay. Like one point in my life, I spoke them in a functional, you know, I could socialize people and function in society. All right. And you know, then I forget them because I haven't spoken them for a really long time. Alcohol helps unleash that. They're basically locked away in a different part of my brain now. Mm-hmm. Alcohol helps loosen it. So my Chinese and German Italian abilities, I'm sure if you charted my fluency, had raters rate my fluency and ability in the language as I drank, there'd be peaks. And it's probably about 0.08 that I'd be at the best because I'd be loose, right? I'd be
right
forgetting that I forgot how to speak German. This is something that is a real effect and it's important. And if you ban alcohol or you banish it from professional contexts, you lose that. And I would predict that organizations that do that are going to lose out to organizations that don't. So,
yeah, as you were talking about that, the usefulness of alcohol in enhancing creativity, I was thinking the way you're talking is the way people now talk about not alcohol, but about cannabis and psychedelic drugs. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep.
And can we talk about that? You know, what's the difference and why is that? Why don't we, well, I guess we've already explained that in a sense. There's been this hostility to alcohol, at least in this culture. But there's been a hostility to drugs too. I guess just recently though, you know, in the last 5 to 10 years, the whole psychonaut, you know, movements, right? Revolving around Joe Rogan and it's interesting and I don't know what to do with it exactly, but I find that's, you know, I find that those people who are part of that movement are very comfortable talking about the wonders, the usefulness of psychedelics, of ayahuasca and cannabis too, but they don't talk about drinking. They do not talk about drinking in this way at all.
Yeah. I think it's because they're pretentious. I think there's just a class. I think it's almost a class thing where it's it's hipster and cool to talk about ayahuasca, but alcohol is what your grandparents drank. Right. So that's not cool. So I think it's partly just a fashion thing. Like alcohol is not as fashionable as these drugs are. There are some legit reasons for valuing them more. In some way, so cannabis and psychedelics are safer, much safer drugs than alcohol.
Right.
Alcohol is a really dangerous drug, as you know, right? It's super physically addictive.
Yep.
And it causes serious physiological damage to individuals in a way that cannabis doesn't really do much and that psychedelics don't do at all. As far as we know, they've got really zero physiological costs. And it's pretty clear, at least I think the data shows that neither cannabis nor any type of psychedelic is physically addictive. It could, you could get psychologically addicted to them, but they're not physically addictive the way alcohol and cocaine and heroin are. So that's one, that's in my view, a legit reason to value those more.
Sure.
But the basic thing they're doing is the same. I mean, the function is downregulating the PFC. What the reason I talk about cannabis and psychedelics in the book as well is I'm talking about intoxication. So they're intoxicants, and the central feature of intoxicants is they're turning down the PFC and letting crosstalk happen in the brain in a way it would normally happen. But the reason that alcohol, I call alcohol the king of intoxicants. And there's a good reason for that, because these other drugs have some really serious downsides. So they've got some advantages, but they have serious downsides. So cannabis, the cognitive effect of cannabis really varies from individual to individual in a way that you don't see with alcohol. What I have friends at grad school who would smoke cannabis and, you know, to go to parties or to go dancing, and, or I waited tables, in school, and I had people I worked with who would smoke up before their waitering shift. Like they'd do it 'cause it made them more energetic and chatty. Yep. Whereas everyone would tell me, just try the strain. You got to try the right, whatever, every type of strain of cannabis I've ever had makes me paranoid. It makes me paranoid and feel really stupid. And then I get horny for like 30 seconds and then I fall asleep. Saying it's like completely useless as a social drug. It's the way it hits me, and every strain does the same thing to me. So cannabis is really variable in its cognitive effects, individual to individual. So that makes it less helpful. That's why you don't have cultures where we sit down and smoke cannabis together before a business deal. The problem with psychedelics is that they so disconnect you from reality that you can't function at all.
Right.
Michael Pollan talks about he's got a really great analogy in that last book, not the most recent one, but the one before, about how to change your mind.
Right.
He compares this kind of scrambling of your brain that psychedelics cause as the cultural evolutionary equivalent to mutations. It's like just like a mutagen. So genetic mutations are necessary for genetic evolution to work. They're mostly harmful, and so most of the time they don't lead to better adaptive function, but sometimes they do, and you need those or evolution wouldn't happen. Cultural evolution needs mutations too. It needs ideas getting put together in new ways, and most of them are going to be nonsense. That's why most of the stuff you write when you're tripping is you look at it the next day and you're like, yeah, right. But every once in a while, something will be great and new and actually genuinely useful. And so the way to look at hallucinogens is they're doing that in a really extreme way. Alcohol is a kind of lower risk but higher payoff way of doing the same thing, because you're allowing crosstalk, but it's not disconnecting you from reality so much. So there's a much higher probability that the stuff you're going to come up with at 0.08 blood alcohol content is going to be actually useful in your real life than what you bring back from an acid trip. I leave the door open to the possibility of microdosing. It's conceivably the case that now that we can synthesize the psychoactive component of psilocybin mushrooms and we have LSD and we can dose it precisely, maybe taking it in small doses would give you the benefits without the really extreme disconnection from reality that the normal dose of it would give you. So that's possible, but you know, microdosing is 10 years old or something, 15 maybe. Whereas with alcohol, we've been figuring out the right dose for 13,000 years. So we just have so much more experience with alcohol.
Right.
It's easy to make. It's, you know, pairs well with food. It has a really short half-life in our body because we've got machinery dedicated to getting it out of our system as quickly as possible. So we could go have a pub session and have two or three beers, come up with some creative stuff. And 2 hours later, we're fine again, right? That's not going to happen, at least right now, with mushrooms. and cannabis is unpredictable. So I think that it's just alcohol. If you had a team of cultural engineers and you were like, we want a substance that's going to have all these traits, it's going to be easy to make, super low tech. You can make it out of anything, any climate, doesn't matter where you live. You can make it, has these effects. I think they would design something very much like alcohol.
No kidding.
If you could get rid of the physical, if you get rid of the physically addictive part of it, it would be the perfect drug. That's really its downside.
Yet I've heard you're quoting someone else, but describe it as a pharmacological hand grenade.
Yeah.
Alcohol.
Yeah.
So can we do the science? Because the thing I was always, when I was a drunk and still to this day, when I would hear alcohol called a depressant, it made no sense to me. I mean, that was certainly never my experience. No,
it's not a depressant.
It was similar to cocaine for me. I mean, I got megalomaniacal. I got, fired and all sorts of things, right? Certainly, it didn't depress me ever.
No, it's a stimulant and a depressant at the same time.
Okay.
and in differing time sequences. So at the ascending arm of intoxication, the stimulating effects are the dominant ones. So you get more energetic, you get happier, you're getting the serotonin rush, you're getting endorphins being released. Mm. The reason this is Stephen Brown, the journalist who called it a pharmacological hand grenade, because it real alcohol combines, it's the drugs like cocaine or heroin or LSD target very particular parts of your brain in a surgical way. Alcohol just comes in and just, it's like a kid running into a control center and just hitting a bunch of buttons all at once. So it's hitting all these different circuits at the same time. So it's raising serotonin, endorphin levels. It's having similar effects to like Valium, cocaine, meth, all at the same time. Prozac, because it's raising serotonin levels. At the same time, it's downregulating your prefrontal cortex. So you're getting that the depressant effects are concentrated in the prefrontal cortex. So that's why you get the disinhibition and the positive effects from that. As blood alcohol content gets higher, then the depressive effects start to go to other parts of the brain, like the motor regions, which is why you stumble, to memory centers, which is why you can't remember what happened the next day. And then what, very high levels of inebriation, it can start to affect your centers of breathing. And that's when it gets really dangerous. Fortunately, most people pass out before they drink that much, but, it gets really dangerous once you get into those higher levels of BAC. But the depressant effects are concentrated at the end, kind of in the come down part of it. But then your brain tries to compensate for that. That's why, alcohol can help you fall asleep, but then you wake up in the middle of the night because it has this depressant effect. It helps you sleep, but then your brain doesn't like that lack of regulation. And so it's ramping up stimulation centers, and that they pop up around 3 a.m. and say, hey, it's time to get up.
I'm just going to say that. Yeah. That was my least favorite part of being a drunk was the 3 a.m. Heart racing thing. Ugh. Horrible.
Yeah. That's your brain trying to compensate for all that depressing action that happened with the alcohol. So alcohol is a really complicated drug, but it seems to be that sequence of events seems to be helpful for us in a lot of ways. I really think if you could just, the worst part of alcohol is the fact that like cocaine and heroin, it's just physically addictive. That's what makes it so dangerous. And then it's clear that probably about 15% of the human population has a genetic predisposition to alcoholism. And it's, there's different degrees of this, right? I see this in my own family. So I have a history of alcoholism in my family, and it's decreased over the generations. You see it, my grandfather, I think, was a lot worse than my father. And I think I'm better than my father. So you have degrees of it. But lots of people have trouble drinking safely. And this is where, Freud, I just don't think gets the interaction of culture and the id, if you want to put it that way. Cultures have different ways of helping individuals moderate themselves. And so one of my arguments in the book is that southern drinking cultures like you find in Italy. So probably because Homo sapiens just had this 15% predisposition to alcoholism. If you look at actual rates of alcoholism, they vary wildly across the world.
Yep.
Russia is really high. The US is really high.
Yep.
Italy is really low,
yeah,
even though they actually drink per capita a lot of alcohol.
Yep.
And so why is that? Are they genetically different? It's not genetics. It's culture. They have a culture where alcohol is consumed at the dinner table exclusively,
right,
at the meal table. So you have it at lunch and dinner. Don't drink away from the table.
Yeah. Doesn't that just completely fuck up the whole theory that it's this biological condition, like that it's genetically determined? I mean, the whole theory of alcoholism in the West, you know, that the Benjamin Rush invented.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that the rates in Finland, I think, are the highest in the world, right? Something like that.
That sounds right. Yeah. They're part of that northern drinking culture. Russia is terrible.
Yeah. Super high. Yeah. And versus countries like Italy and Asian countries, especially, right? Very low mm-hmm. rates.
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't that tell us right there that it's not biologically determined?
Well, nothing. So determinism is a weird word, right? Nothing's biologically determined, right? So you have a predisposition.
I don't think so, but a lot of people do.
Yeah. I mean, it would be some things are determined, like that you're going to die at some point,
right?
But at least right now. But so you have a predisposition, and you can have a really strong predisposition or a weak predisposition that's going to get influenced by environmental factors, including culture, right? And then culture can reshape your dispositions in various ways. If you live in a culture that encourages binge drinking and drinking distilled liquors, which are wildly more dangerous than beers and wines, any proclivities you're going to have to drink to excess are just going to get exacerbated. If you live in a culture that drinks primarily beers and wines in moderation with meals around the meal table, that frowns upon drinking to get drunk, that frowns upon drinking by yourself away from the dinner table, that's going to push you in a different direction. So culture is moderating genetic predispositions in all sorts of ways. So I think what you're seeing is that healthy drinking cultures can serve as a safety net for people who otherwise biologically are going to have a problem drinking safely.
Right.
And so that gives, you know, I think it's an optimistic theme that you can use cultural practices to help you if you have problems with drinking. And it may be the case that for some people, really the only safe amount is zero because mm-hmm. their predisposition is so strong.
Right.
But there's got to be people who have alcohol use disorder, some degree of alcohol use disorder, who can drink safely if they come up with ritual practices around it. You know, I only drink at the dinner table.
Right.
There's all sorts of tricks I talk about in the book that people can use. You know, you use a smaller wine glass. Is amazingly mm-hmm. effective. It's like the effect mm-hmm. on binge eating, right? You give people smaller dinner plates at a buffet where they can actually take as much food as they want. Mm-hmm. If you give them a smaller plate, they take less food because psychologically mm-hmm. going back a third time seems a little bit excessive. You give people smaller wine glasses, they're going to drink less because right. they ask for a third fill up seems kind of excessive. There are little tricks like this you can play. I talk about the Greeks who served wine in these cups that were actually very difficult to handle. They spilled easily. They were shallow mm-hmm. and didn't have very pronounced lips on them. Mm-hmm. And so at a certain point of inebriation, you can't really drink anymore because you keep spilling your wine. And that's actually a really clever way to limit wine consumption. It's like, it's almost like a car that won't drive if you're at a certain level of inebriation.
Yeah.
So there are tricks you can use to help steer whatever biological disposition you have in a better direction.
Do you think that the Southern European model is the best, that it's sort of communal, social, rather than individual? You know, for me, I was very American. I would just get a bottle of Jack Daniels and drink by myself watching TV.
That's so unhealthy.
The worst possible way to do it.
The worst possible way.
And but the Southern Europeans, you know, famously do it very differently, as you've said already.
Yeah,
is that not what you would prescribe for Americans?
Yeah, no, that's what I think. So having more of that style of drinking is healthy. I mean, it's funny because it, you know, my ex-wife is half Italian. We spent a lot of time in Italy. We have a lot of relatives there. And I remember my first time going and living with the family there, staying with her brother-in-law. You know, people had wine around the dinner table. We all drank wine and it was amazing wine. You know, you get I'm really into wine, and it was just this mind blowing wine for nothing. Like, it was so cheap. And so I wanted to take a glass of it up to bed with me to kind of drink, you know, enjoy it while I was reading my book or whatever I was reading. And I could see people were just like, what the fuck are you doing? Taking wine by yourself to your room.
That's you American?
Really weird. Yeah. And it's amazing how powerful, no one said anything, but that social, like, that's a little sketchy, made me the next night go, okay, I'm not going to do that tonight, you know, and that probably meant I drank less wine. Right. So it's things like that can be really helpful. It's just, they're tricks that cultures can use to help individuals, and therefore to help themselves. You know, it's better for a culture to have lower levels of alcoholism. You know, you see cultures like, I would say, you know, certainly the former Soviet Union, like in the 90s.
Oh, God.
Where vodka really, like, seriously damaged society and set them back in a variety of ways, right? And the same thing happened to the English in the 1700s with gin, right? There's this gin epidemic. And it's significant that it's happening with distilled liquors. I mean, those are the most dangerous substances. And they're relatively recent. Another thing in the book that I talk about is distilled liquors are a recent invention. Like, we really didn't in Europe have widespread access to them until the 16, 1700s. And that's in the story that I'm telling, where we starts 10 million years ago with our primate ancestors who adapted to eating fermented fruit. That's yesterday. It's blink of an eye.
Sure.
And so I think distilled liquors, another theme of the book is that distilled liquors are a new danger, and they're much more dangerous than beers and wines. And we should really treat them as a separate class of drug, I think.
Yeah, that's the hand grenade, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Those are super dangerous. Yeah. You blow drinking distilled liquor, you blow past 0.08 immediately.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I knew when I graduated from beer to whiskey and gin, I knew that I was entering a new realm here.
Yeah. A new realm of danger.
Yeah. And not a great one. It was fun, but very not good for me. Can we finish? Would you mind talking about your own personal relationship with drinking?
Okay.
I mean, what is it? I may hear a little bit about, you have a history of alcoholism in the family and you like wine. I'm wondering if that had anything to do with you writing the book.
Probably. You know, certainly I love wine. I'm really into wine.
What do you love about it?
It's just infinitely complex. I mean, you could never stop learning about it. It's just, even like just Italy, like, it would take me the rest of my life to even understand the basics of wine in Italy, just the different grape varieties and how they're treated and the flavor profiles. I just think it's, aesthetically, it's a source of, like, nonstop surprise and enjoyment. But I also like being intoxicated. Like, I like alcohol. So I think that, you know, I definitely am at the high end of drinking for North Americans. And I'm conscious of the family history I have of alcoholism.
You mean you drink more than
average? I think I drink more, quantity wise than most people. And this is something my GP and I monitor. And she's always, as a GP, she's like, you really should cut down your drinking. And I say, yes, I should. And I don't. And, you know, the pandemic made it much worse because you're stuck. I've been stuck alone and quarantined for, I did 10 quarantines, two Whoa. Weeks each. So I spent a lot of time alone in my apartment, which is really unhealthy for, you know, again, one of the themes of the book is don't drink alone.
Yeah.
And I was drinking, I had no choice but to drink alone. So it's funny. I see all the benefits of alcohol, but I'm acutely aware of the dangers. And I'm always kind of alert to my own over drinking. Like I monitor myself. I don't entirely trust myself because of my family history. Mm-hmm. So I think that people who have a family history of alcoholism need to just monitor shit and objectively, like really kind of keep track of, oh, how many, you know, how much of a bottle of wine do I drink in the course of an evening? And if you find that you're drinking more than you really, you should be, or it's affecting your life. I mean, you know, the alcohol use disorder is rated on a questionnaire. I think it's the standard diagnostic one has maybe 10 questions. And if you answer yes to more than two or three of them, you're kind of somewhere on the alcohol use disorder spectrum. And those would be useful questions for anyone who's worried about their family history or their drinking to keep in mind.
Okay.
Like one of them is, you know, do you ever find yourself drinking more than you wanted to, than more than you planned at the beginning of the evening? Hmm. Do you ever find yourself the next morning unable to complete your work or being suboptimal at your work because of your drinking the night before, things like that? And if you're answering yes to too many of those questions, you might need some help, right?
Right. Okay.
So I'm aware of that, and I definitely monitor my drinking. So I don't think I'm, you know, when I talk about the downsides of alcohol and the dangers, this isn't like some bullshit thing my editor made me throw in so that, you know, I wouldn't get persecuted. I'm acutely aware of the dangers of alcohol, and I wish it were a better drug. I wish it were not physically addictive.
Me too.
And so harmful. Yeah. Right. So I think you can recognize the dangers of alcohol and be worried about your own personal use of it while still trying to give it an ecological niche in your daily life. Okay. So that's, I think, the best we can do.
Okay. Wow. Edward, this has been tremendous. I mean, really,
it's been a lot of fun.
Wonderful. I mean, I loved your book. I've heard you being interviewed in other places, but I learned so much from this, and I just loved how open you are about all this. And it's really fascinating and inspiring in a way, because I do think that, you know, breaking this Freudian model apart a bit could really lead to some very useful social change.
Yeah. No, I hope so.
Yeah. So thank you so much for this.
All right. No, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. To join the new Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners group for the podcast, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for listening.